All right. We are back. This is going to be episode 7 of the podcast. It's going to be another solo one. We're missing some folks today. It's a rainy Wednesday. Fraser, a little MIA today. Matt, I think, is working on something. Didn't want to make the trek into the city. That's fine. Happy to do this one again. I think the usual tone of the podcast is probably inappropriate for this week anyway. Probably shouldn't just get on the mic and joke around, make dick jokes like we typically do. We're getting worse and worse. The world is getting worse and worse. And news like someone lighting themselves on fire as a protest is being quieted and not covered. And the desperation which someone like Aaron Bushnell might have felt cannot be replicated. Cannot be expressed to the popular consciousness. There's both the intense dedication and tragedy and heroicness of doing something like Aaron Bushnell did. And with, especially in the face of contemporary Western society, contemporary American society, let's not blame this on anyone but us who are the last ones standing, and will remain the last ones standing until something much more dramatic than lighting yourself on fire even happens. This is the true sadness of the Bushnell video to me, is seeing it and understanding that, one, it won't be covered. If it will, it will be covered as a, what are we gonna call this? A plight of the mentally ill, of someone of not sound mind and body, taking their own life for a cause that they could never fully understand the complexities of. That's how they love to talk about it, right? That you could never understand the complexity of the issue, so why don't you just leave it alone? There's that. That's one element of sadness, and the other side is it's not just the fact that it'll be snuffed out by the tyrannical fashion in which news and media is ran in this country, but the other part is that on the independent level, that of the consumer, that of us with the capacity to see this, we too don't know how to take it. Our brains have effectively been fried on that sort of thing, if you ask me. It's the end of sincerity. It's the end of sentimentality. It's the end of empathy. You have to crack a joke. Someone does, and that's the initial response that I'm seeing across the internet, which I guess is and in person to person conversation. No one has the capacity, in my mind, to actually feel this and understand this. I think I'm not gonna downplay this. There's already been an optimistically a positive impact of his act, that people were seem to be organizing and charging up and getting together, but it's hard not to feel like we've been here before, right? We've organized, we've gotten together, we've peacefully protested. I think everyone remembers the George Floyd summer. We remember how we felt during that time. We remember reaching out and wanting to do the best we want. We remember even taking to the streets. You know, in Minneapolis, they burned down the fucking police station. But we also saw how that kind of all ended. Nothing changed, did it? What really changed? The body count gets higher and higher. And the way that we talk about it gets more and more further from the point. Every single death that happens, the less we can care about it. And all that's left is over sentimentality, a nastiness, a certain type of self-important drama that no longer is interested in making you understand the plight of a class of people that have been attacked and mutilated in this country, and moves that whatever interest that might be into the expressor themselves, or into you yourself. It became this narcissistic impulse that we can't resist, right? It became we all had to start doing the work, right? We had to begin our anti-racist work. We had to buy the big three books. We had to buy Ibram X. Kendi's book, and all the others. We had to get the variety pack, and we had to display it on our shelves, and read as much of it as we could, and begin the psychoanalysis of our racist being, our racist innards. It's not the fucking issue. I mean, of course it's the issue that everyone's inherently racist, and that we all perceive the world in a biased fashion, and that is located in historical factors that are built around the racial exploitation of a people. And if you are white in this country, you've inherited that. That is in your brain, and it'll be there forever, and you need to spend some conscious effort subduing that and trying to get away from it. But that is not the time to have that conversation, if you ask me. Once the activity of public or of mass organization was taking place, it should interest some of us that the thing that begins to get put out there is the return to the inwardness. Do you want to defeat racism in America? Sure you do. All you have to do is perform therapy upon yourself. Think about it really hard. And feel bad about it, of course. You know, if you feel just bad enough about it, and think just hard enough about it, that's all it'll take. This is, you know, time-tested. Time-tested is moments when America sees itself in the mirror for what it really is, and progressive action, the public consciousness sways towards, well, maybe we can do something to organize against this. Maybe we can really, really get going. Maybe we can, you know, maybe we should break something here and there. The first thing you're gonna see come out is a invitation back to the inner, a invitation out of the streets and into the office of the psychotherapist. to examine your inner racism. And so what this is all circling around, and what I really want to talk about today has to do with our capacity to understand atrocity as it is displayed to us through art, and how our art that would help us understand atrocity has been co-opted. It's been taken away, and like I said the last time I did one of these, it's not really the artist's fault. These aren't you know, acting or conscious acting actors. These aren't intelligence officers that are being planted into MFA programs saying, "All right, learn to write a good novel, and we'll make you the most famous thing there is, and that'll put it into that." You know, Otessa Moshfegh is probably just a nice person, and she probably cares a lot about literature. She's probably smart. She probably has read a lot. And she's written, and she writes well. But it is out of her control why she is who she is, why her works have become the way they have become. And, you know, it's truly a difference of perception. It's a difference of a different mindset. The way that you look at the world has to be the correct way. But let's talk about the atrocity art and the issue. So, I mean, I think everyone has heard the famous line by the famous poet who I can't remember his fucking name. But the line is, after the Holocaust, there is no poetry. You can't write poetry after an atrocity such as that one has occurred. What is meant by that? What is the idea in that? We shouldn't say anything poetic. Poetry itself as a practice is done. I think, yes. What is really meant by that is poetry, or traditional understanding of poetry, in which one during that time might have looked to their world and seen themselves in it and contemplated how much they are there and how much they are not. The connection to the world around you, the playful identification of the self across all that the gaze can capture, and the playful construction of sound and meaning, of messing around for messing around's sake, of a playful sonic medium. The issue is that the ground in which that type of poetry was being written changed. It was different after World War II. Or maybe it was always the same, and there have been people that have recognized this forever, that it's human nature, really, that we are evil, and that there is nothing about us in the world around us. All that is in us that can be reflected back to us are in the things that we make. The natural world does not care for us. We are not in that natural world. That is not ours. We may occupy it with varying degrees of success and harmony, but we are a burden. And people and writers and artists have understood this, and some have fought against it. And I don't think it's the most optimistic or nice thing to think, and you know, most days I would try to do my best not to think about that. But it is true. And what this relates to in terms of the expression of an atrocity, the expression of experiencing mass pain, and our incapacity to do so successfully using traditional means, and our inability to receive it successfully through traditional means. It's not enough just to recite the event back. I cannot just tell you what happened and you feel it. And the thing on the line here is important. Because we have no capacity to understand the atrocity at hand, it's bound to repeat, correct? This might, I don't know if people are going to fight against art's responsibility in the world, but it's hard not to think such a thing after however long between the Holocaust of of World War II upon the Jewish people of Europe, and enough time went by that descendants of these people are now committing their own Holocaust upon a different type of person, based solely upon race. This is a racial cleansing that's occurring. This is a Holocaust. And so, I'm not a political scientist. I am not an economic mind. I don't know much beyond art. But I do understand something that has been occurring since the end of World War II up until today, and that is public consumption of atrocity art as inefficient. We don't have the tools. We don't have the tools to understand mass pain as a human experience. This is what we're talking about when poetry is over. A human experience, an expression of a human experience to another, was maybe the basis of the written of written expression for a time. But that understanding requires you to believe that all you've experienced can be at least expressed and maybe felt across the page. But how do you express being dehumanized? How do you express being treated like cattle? Being seen as less and killed on the basis of nothing beyond just where you were from, who you are, what your particular set of birth conditions. How do you express that? How do you express that successfully to someone? How can someone that has never felt such a thing and never will feel such a thing, most likely, how can you make them feel that? Well, I mean, it seems the answer that most people are interested in for however long has been, well, we'll repeat the event as quote unquote realistic fashion as possible. We'll make a soap opera out of it, you know? We'll Schindler's List, right? We'll make a drama. And that's how we connect with people. We connect with people through drama, or the arts connect with people through drama. We attach them to these narratives through tricks of suspense, and we garner their attention for 2 hours at a time. And in there, we'll implant a special meaning. Well, they'll learn something because we have their attention so wrapped. But it didn't work, right? It doesn't work. It doesn't work to just see a cartoonization of the events. Because if you really, how graphic can you get? You know, there are other ways to do it. And who knows what you're supposed to do? Maybe, you know, the issue is the way in which popular media is consumed. Because there are films that have successfully made me feel maybe not the plight of a genocided people, but it certainly made me feel like shit. Have you ever seen Come and See? The movie about the Belarusian genocide occurring alongside the Jewish genocide during World War II. That movie is plenty expressive of pain. But even so, it's a little surreal. It's done a little differently. It's not a straight telling of the Belarusian genocide. It's not a straight realistic drama. It's surreal, right? There are scenes in which it's really real, I guess. The Nazis that you experience are not the evil men of Spielberg. They're Boy Scouts. They're young boys in a foreign country without the capacity to understand empathy. They're all 18. They're out there. They're doing it, and they're rounding up everyone on the basis of what they've been told to do, and they're doing an honorable thing in their eyes, and they're getting carried away. And the real thing that is so terrifying about that film is how much fun that the Nazis have when they burn down a barn full of people, and the pain that's expressed, it's not in the centers in which you would expect it. It's expressed differently. I mean, the scenes in which make you feel the most are strange. When the two main characters, these young children, are wading through a bog, they're caught and they're drowning in a swamp. It's disgusting, but it's the most heart-wrenching part of the whole film, that you can really feel the desperation. You can feel what it's like to be nothing. It's in the context of the Holocaust, but in order to feel the Holocaust, you step away from the Nazis and you put these two characters into the woods, and you make them drown in a bog, and then maybe we as viewers can start to understand what it's like to be dehumanized by an insurmountable force, for your entire world to be taken away from you, and you turn into nothing. It's not enough just to say it. It's much like drowning in a swamp. Right? That's what we're talking about here, is it's these acts that are, they're not, I can tell you the numbers, I can tell you how many people died out there, I can tell you how they died too. Does it make a difference? Does it help you feel it? Can you feel it? And the answer is no, you can't. They're just your mind doesn't have that capacity. It shuts off. Maybe it's some type of learned defense, you know, maybe this is a way in which you continue to survive without, because if you could feel the pain of others, or if you could feel the pain of mass death, then perhaps you wouldn't survive. Perhaps you would, it would be all too much. I want to turn to a writer that has spent a lot of time considering how to express mass death, how to express the atrocity. And the writer is W.G. Sebald. Sebald, for his whole life, is a writer that is concerned with understanding this atrocity. There's a famous story of him in boarding school, in German high school. And he's shown pictures of the Holocaust, and everyone sits there and watches and looks. But after class, no one can actually understand what was shown to them. And these two things just become the life of Sebald. Understanding of the past and photography's capacity to contain the past, the image and the word, and how those two can interact, and how our mind can be evoked, how to actually access something like public consciousness. He wrote a bunch of novels. He died tragically when he was 50, I think in 2001, from a heart attack, which I think he knew was coming for quite some time. He was aware that he had a cardiac issue that would eventually take him. I have a professor that maybe I won't name on this podcast, but when I was still in school, had a dinner with Sebald, and this is a professor that is amazed by Sebald, that and as everyone was during that time, everyone found he was the greatest, latest and greatest, and adored by everyone in the literary establishment. Everyone wanted to talk to him, and part of the reason that a lot of people think that he died is because the literary establishment demanded too much of this old man with a weak heart. Well, he wasn't old. This middle-aged man with a very weak heart. But during the dinner that this professor had with him, I recall the story of being so excited to finally meet this person and finally get to talk to him, but being struck by how deflated he was in person. He asked to leave dinner early. He barely talked to anyone. And my professor, on the ride home, finally got him to say something. And it was simply, more or less, he couldn't stand to be spoken to that way, to be examined, to be an object of inquiry. And I think, it is quite sad that this man was consumed in such a way by the establishment, which would later forget him and start to publish bullshit. But while he was on Earth, he provided us with some great novels. And these novels concern mass memory. How do we understand the past, and specifically, How do we understand the awful things that have happened in our past, and how do we connect to them? Sebald is very interested in heritage. How, if you can go far back down the line, you know, where does it find you? And he's very interested in details, in how to actually enter into someone's mind, how to actually make them feel something. Within the first pages of The Rings of Saturn, we begin to hear about Flaubert, and this kind of sets us up for what's to come in the novel. He's speaking of a dead peer who has studied French novels, and Michael studied at Oxford, and over the years had come to a profound understanding of the 19th century French novel, and had about it a certain private quality, wholly free of intellectual vanity, and was guided by a fascination for obscure detail rather than the self-evident. Flaubert was for her by far the finest of writers, and on many occasions she quoted long passages from the thousands of pages of his correspondence, never failing to astound me. Janine had taken intense personal interest in the scruples which dogged Flaubert's writing, that fear of the false which, she said, sometimes kept him confined to his couch for weeks or months on the end, in the dread that he would never be able to write another word without compromising himself in the most grievous ways. Moreover, Janine said, he was convinced that everything he had written hitherto consisted solely in a string of the most abysmal errors and lies, the consequence of which were immeasurable. Janine maintained that the source of Flaubert's scruples was to be found in the relentless spread of stupidity which he had observed everywhere, and which he believed had already invaded his own head. That's within, like, the first two pages of The Rings of Saturn. And what we're talking about here, and what Flaubert is concerned for, is the public's capacity to understand things, and the damning effects of intellectual vanity, the damning effects of overtness, of making things too much about things, to the point where we can no longer understand the thing in question. If you make the thing about the thing, one's capacity to understand the thing is taken away. But if you make a thing with perhaps the thing in mind, but not overtly about it, perhaps somewhere in the details of the thing that you make, one's capacity to understand it is greater. And so, if you read Flaubert, if you read Madame Bovary, this is what you're given. It's a novel about the stupidity and vanity of the bourgeois class and their insatiable desire to be fulfilled, while also simultaneously cheapening every single thing that might lead to fulfillment in the world through petty mercantilism, through devaluing everything. They both want everything, but their simple existence gets rid of everything that they want. And Flaubert sees this, and Flaubert is in fact a part of this. This is what he understands as the modern condition, that they are watching the world as they understood it slip away, and what is in its place is a disgusting thing. And the more that you ache for the past, the worse it gets. The worse that your state here becomes. But it's not enough just to say that to someone. You can't just, you'll never feel that. What you can do is make a novel in which it is threaded in the details. You can make a very long very personal novel about a very tragic woman, Emma Bovary, and her desire to be taken away by anything. Her desire, her absolute willingness to give herself up to anything and everything that will give her rapture from the blank boringness of bourgeois life, and how it continues to lead to her demise. And it's there not just in the plot details, it's there in the simple construction of image. Sometimes clearer than not, every little segue, every little intensely drawn painting and image of Madame Bovary, that's where the information's at. That's where you might find what he's really saying. But it's because he's the mind is allowed to unravel. What it really feels and thinks is here in the image. And what you really feel and think is there in the image. It's where the communion can occur. There's no communion in me telling you what's up. There's no communion in me saying, here is atrocity, here is the awfulness of modernity. Feel it. Do you feel it? Of course not. You don't feel it. You can't feel that. But if I were to maybe prime you and say, here's a character that is suffering from the ailments of modernity, and let me talk about this chair for quite some time. Let me talk about this hat for some time. Let me do this thing where I'm very strangely going on and on and on about seemingly nothing. And while I'm going on and on about seemingly nothing, your mind will wander, and it'll begin to place things in certain places. You'll begin to see the themes of the novel, the big capital T themes, there in the image, there in the details. This is how it works. This is real. This is how you feel in art. Is through the non-overt, through the tightly constructed image. And so we moved on from Flaubert, and we begin to think about the Holocaust. We begin to think about the atrocities of the Second World War and onward. And we begin to wonder, how do we make people feel that? How can I express this? And as we've already said, it can't be expressed. Like, you can't feel it if I just tell it to you. It doesn't make a difference. And you can't feel it if I just show it to you. If I show you the Holocaust, if I create something that I say is the Holocaust, I will succumb to falseness, as Flaubert worried. If I try to create an image of atrocity and say this is the atrocity, this is falseness, and I've misguided you. And you will now mistake the thing that I have shown you as the thing itself. And we all think we're adults, right? We all think, well, I know that that's not really how it was. This is just like a dramatization of how it was. But what else do you know? That's all you know, right? Like, you don't know anything else. So the dramatization, like, you can say, I know this is not it, but you don't know anything else. So, over time, it becomes it. It is how you understand it. When you think of the Holocaust, you think of Schindler's List. Because you don't have the alternative. You can't look at the raw data of it and understand anything of it. Other than it's terrifying. And that's the other side of this. If you look at the raw data of it, and if you look at the raw images of it, it's too much to bear. if you, it's too much for the senses to see the piled bodies. It's too much for the senses to see the starvation. And you enter into defense mode. You shut off. You quit looking at that. You can only bear so much. And so how do you, so what you're left with is, in your understanding of the past and its atrocities, you can either feel shocked and disgusted by the raw images and data available of it, or you can feel it falsely in a fashion that is palpable. This is the issue. This is why historic memory is complicated. Because either side is, you don't have the tools to deal with. You either take the falsehood as the real, as the realness, or you take the realness as overbearing, and you shut it out of your mind. You take the realness as falsehood. And so there has to be another way, right? This is Sebald's point. This is Sebald's concern, is there has to be another way for us to understand it. And how might we do that? We do that through a lacing of details and through a less than overt narrative, something that hints upon what we're really talking about, paired with images that might hint about what we're really talking about, but taken outside of themselves are singular and ununderstandable. It's the juxtaposition of the things that creates the feeling. If you ever read a Sebald novel, perhaps you'll be aware of what I'm talking about here, is that there is a feeling of unexplainable upon finishing one. They're not, you can't tell someone what it's like to read these novels. They, the feelings that they create in you are not describable. They're all-encompassing. All you can really say is, that's exactly right. That's exactly how it is. And so, Sebald might do this by, in a number of ways. He might do this in a number of ways.
In the way to, we'll look at something directly. In the eighth chapter of Rings of Saturn, we're displayed this technique of tickling the historical memory, and how to make something really feel the way that it is. It begins the chapter the following way. The day after my visit to Middleton, I fell into a conversation with a Dutchman named Cornelius de Jong in a bar of the Crown Hotel in Southwold. He had been to Suffolk on a number of occasions and was now thinking of buying one of the vast properties, often running to more than 1,000 hectares, that are regularly offered by estate agents hereabouts. De Jong told me that he had grown up on a sugar plantation near Surbaya, and later, after studying at the Wagnerian Agricultural College, continued the family tradition in a somewhat stationed fashion as a sugar beet farmer in the Deventer area. If he was now planning to transfer his interest to England, it was primarily for economic reasons, said De Jong. Single estates of the size regularly appearing in the East England market never came up for sale in Holland, and manor houses of the kind that were particularly thrown in for nothing with the land here were not to be found at home either. In their heyday, said De Jong, the Dutch invested chiefly in cities, while the English put their money into country estates. That evening in the bar, we talked till last orders recalled about the rise and decline of the two nations and about the curiously close relationship that existed until well into the 20th century between the history of sugar and the history of art. For long periods of time, there was little scope for ostentatious display of accumulated wealth, and consequently, the enormous profits that accrued to the few families who grew and traded in sugarcane were regularly lavished on the building, furnishing, and maintenance of magnificent country residences, and stately townhouses. It was Cornelius de Jong who drew my attention to the fact that many important museums, such as the, I don't know how to say this one, Muthurusis, that's probably wrong, in The Hague, or the Tate Gallery in London, were originally endowed by the sugar dynasties, or were in some other way connected with the sugar trade. The capital amassed in the 18th and 19th centuries through various forms of slave economy is still in circulation, said De Jong, still bearing interest, increasing many times over and continually burgeoning anew. One of the most tried and tested ways of legitimizing this kind of money has always been patronage of the arts, the purchase and exhibiting of painting and sculptures, a practice which today, said De Jong, was leading to a relentless escalation of prices paid at major auctions. Within a few years, 100 million mark for half a square yard of painted canvas will have been passed. At times it seems to me, said De Jong, if all works of art were coated with sugar glaze, or indeed made completely of sugar, like the model of the Battle of Estrejum, created by a confectioner to the Viennese court, which Empress Maria Theresa, so it is said, devoured in one of her most recurrent bouts of melancholy. The morning after a conversation in the Crown Hotel bar, which expanded to the plantation and production methods employed by the Dutch East Indies, I drove down to Woodbridge with De Jong. Here on this page, as this paragraph is starting, we're given a black and white photo above. And it is of slaves in a sugar cane field, or perhaps not even, you know, it is people farming, and it is displayed without comment and without, you make the assumption that this is a sugar cane field and these are slaves that are tending to the farm, and most of them are wearing hats, and there is an overseer, and there is a black person there, and so the picture is rather obvious on what it is. But it continues on. You slap this little picture in here of slaves working in a sugar field, and then you continue to talk like this. The arable land he wanted to view stretched westward from the outskirts of the small town and was bordered to the north by the deserted estate of Bourges, which I had in any case intended to visit, for it was in Bourges that the writer Edward Fitzgerald grew up almost 200 years ago, and there too he was buried in the summer of 1883. After I parted from Cornelius de Jong with a warmth which it seemed he returned, I first crossed the fields from the A12 towards Bredfield. Fitzgerald was born on the 31st of March, 1809, at the White House, of which all now remains was the orangery. The main wing of the building, which went back to the mid-18th century, could accommodate a large family with a no less numerous staff and servants, was leveled to the ground in May 1944, when one of the German V-bombs, which the English nicknamed Doodlebugs, suddenly deviated from its course and caused wholly pointless damage to remote Bredfield. Bourges Hall, the neighboring manor house to which the Fitzgeralds moved in 1812, was also gone. After it burned down in 1926, the charred walls long remained standing in the heart of the estate. Not until after the Second World War was the ruin completely demolished, presumably for building material. The park itself is now neglected, and the grass has gone unmowed for years. The great oaks are dying branch by branch, and the driveways, patched up here and there with broken bricks, are full of potholes brimming with black water. The copse, which encloses the little church of the Bourges, which the Fitzgeralds restored in rather infectious fashion, is similarly neglected. Rotting timber, rusting iron, and other debris lies around elsewhere. The graves are half sunk into the ground, overshadowed by the encroaching sycamores. Small wonder, I thought, that Fitzgerald, who abhorred funerals and indeed every kind of ceremony, did not wish to be buried in this somber place and want his ashes scattered on the glittering waters of the sea. If, nonetheless, he lies here in a grave beside the hideous family mausoleum, it is owing to one of those wicked ironies against even last wills and testaments are powerless. What are we talking about here? Nothing. You know, we are given the detail that the history of art is a history of laundering money accrued through the slave trade. And we're given evidence of it. We're giving a quick snapshot of slaves at work in a sugar field. And then we go on. We begin to talk about a writer, Fitzgerald, and his relation to his family and his estate, and how his estate's declining, where he's buried, and all this land that's in decline. And what this makes me feel is true sadness. This is historical memory. This is enslaving people on the basis of race in order for nothing but vanity, in order to create estates that we will later detest. We placed people in fields and made them work until they died in order for us to prove how lavish we are, in order to make these buildings that when we walk upon in the modern times, all we can see is its dilapidated state, the black water seeping up from the driveway, the rotted sycamores. What was the point? That's how that should feel. That's how it does feel. It doesn't feel that way when you look at just the raw pictures of slavery. That's not enough for you to understand the experience of this atrocity. The fullness of it is looking at the details that remain. What was it for? What did it create? Why did we demolish these people? Was it simply because there was no reason not to? Because it was the impulse to show that your family was great. That's the heritage. That's all that's remaining. That's all that you can see. That's one way to talk about it. That's one way to talk about atrocity is through the details, through the side door. And that's how Sebald does it. That's how Sebald makes you really feel. And once you really, I'm sure we've all had the experience of laying around with a loved one and feeling something that is difficult to describe to them. A sadness from years before or that you can't explain. What's wrong? I don't know. I can't tell you. It's complicated. But it's been evoked in this moment, in this random gazing thing that I really feel. Who knows if writing like this will really prevent the next Holocaust. And perhaps that's the bit, right? Maybe nothing can. Maybe that is hardwired into the human psyche is to accumulate resources and to dehumanize others in order to do it. Maybe. But in terms of expressing it in art, there has to be a different way. And you have to try it other ways. And who knows why, who knows if it's a worthwhile cause, but you might as well give it a shot. there's no reason not to. It's the only thing that might give you a little bit of energy in these types of days. I think that's all I have today. I think that's all where I'm going to leave it at. It's a strange time to make stuff. It's a hard time to make stuff. It's a hard time to know exactly what you should be doing and how you can make any difference, and maybe you can't. But they certainly can try. Keep it up. Thanks for listening. That is the end of that one, I guess. All right, I'll see you later. All right.